Thanks, Lydia, for your kind words. I'm delighted to be here this afternoon. This is my first visit to Baylor, and it's always nice to see places you've only heard about. I'm also delighted to have met so many new people and to have made some new friends. And as I spend most of my life among the Presbyterians, it's been educational to pass a few days with these people called Baptists. I think you seem, for the most part, to be okay. Let me also thank Manette Pratt, whose gracious support has made this event possible. For almost 1,700 years, Christians regarded the four canonical Gospels as being, among other things, records of what actually happened. Divine inspiration seemed to guarantee historical veracity, as did the belief that the purported authors of these Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, were either eyewitnesses or friends of eyewitnesses. An additional reason for trust was the supposition that the evangelical stories fulfill many of the messianic oracles in the Jewish Bible. The upshot was the conviction that Jesus said and did everything that the Gospels have him say and do. To read them was to encounter him as he once walked upon the earth. There were, to be sure, some moderating voices. Some, such as the church fathers Papias and Jerome, were fully aware that the Gospels don't agree on the sequence in which events happened. And Martin Luther thought that Mark 13, the eschatological discourse, is a bit misleading because it doesn't preserve the order of the words as Jesus spoke them. John Calvin also sat loose on some things. He recognized, for instance, that Matthew 5 through 7, the Sermon on the Mount, and Matthew 10, the missionary discourse, are secondary compilations. According to Calvin, the first evangelist, for thematic reasons, gathered into his discourses words that at one time were scattered, words that Jesus originally uttered on diverse occasions. Even more clear-eyed was Origen, who in the third century anticipated modern criticism by candidly observing that, and I will quote, "At many points, the four Gospels do not agree." He inferred that their truth can't reside in the material letter. "The evangelists sometimes," he wrote, "altered things which, from the eye of history, occurred otherwise. They could speak of something that happened in one place as if it had happened in another, or of what happened at a certain time as if it had happened at another time. And they introduced into what was spoken in a certain way some changes of their own." Then he wrote, "The spiritual truth was often preserved, one might say, in the material falsehood." Now, despite the observations of Origen and a few other attentive readers, serious doubt over the historical fidelity of the canonical Gospels never, to my knowledge, assailed anyone in the ancient or medieval church. But a series of historical developments, the critical study of texts initiated during the Renaissance, the Protestant critiques of Roman Catholic religion, tradition, the growing secularism in the wake of the wars of religion, the skepticism of tradition that attended the Enlightenment, conspired to fashion new ways of understanding the scriptures, not only outside the church, but also within it. And those new ways eventually led, perhaps inevitably, to the modern quest of the historical Jesus, which has been going on now for 2.5 centuries. Remarkably, many pew-sitters remain happily oblivious to it all. They have somehow avoided most or even all of the serious intellectual commentary on the Gospels since the Enlightenment. Perhaps typical are the two churches I grew up in. One Presbyterian, one Congregationalist. Never in Sunday school or from the pulpit or anywhere else did I hear anything of the modern debates surrounding Jesus and the Gospels. Ignorance, it's said, is voluntary misfortune. Still, one expects something from one's teachers. Either my pastors knew nothing about the debates regarding Jesus, or they consciously kept a convenient silence. Perhaps they were persuaded that their congregants did not need to know what they knew, and maybe they worried that curiosity might kill the Christian. I recall that Maldonatus says somewhere, "It is a duty for us to doubt for others, lest they doubt for themselves." In any case, my pastors failed one inquisitive teenager miserably. I had to stumble onto the almost invisible topic all on my own, without help from the church, and then I had to wonder, sitting alone in my bedroom, why all the secrecy? Why hasn't anyone told me about this? Once I began to read the literature, the critical literature, I suffered theological confusion and anxiety, as must many churchgoers today when they learn of the quest for the first time through National Public Radio or Time Magazine, or when they browse the offerings of a bookstore, stumble onto the various titles about Jesus, and then actually read a couple. Once becoming aware of this strange new world of the critical historians, Christians may well wonder whether the quest is a subject that they can, having learned about it, safely ignore, or whether it instead confronts them with facts that should amend, perhaps significantly, their inherited religious convictions. They may, for instance, you may, for instance, fret upon learning that many modern scholars don't believe that Matthew wrote Matthew or that Jesus spoke the discourses in John. They, or you, may also, depending upon your background, find yourselves vexed upon becoming persuaded that the old props, miracles, eyewitness origins, the proof from prophecy have seemingly fallen to the ground and are in need of being themselves propped up or maybe abandoned as everlasting ruins. What should you think? What should we think? I'm not sure what you should think because I'm not sure what I myself think. So in the time you have graciously given me, I shall frequently revert to the interrogatory mode. And that's where I'd like to start right now, with this big question. What do we, especially if we want to do something theological with modern historical conclusions, make of the circumstance that so many different candidates are in the running for the title, the historical Jesus? As many of you know, more than one historical Jesus resides between the covers of today's books. We indeed have a plethora of them. There's the Jesus of Tom Wright, a Jewish prophet and forerunner of Christian orthodoxy. There's the Jesus of Marcus Borg, a spiritual mystic who dispensed perennial wisdom. There's the Jesus of Ed Sanders, an eschatological prophet of Jewish restoration. There's the Jesus of John Dominic Crossan, a Galilean but peasant-like cynic whose vision of an egalitarian kingdom and nonviolent God stood in stark contrast to the power politics of Roman domination. One could go on. To the outsider, theories about Jesus seem to crisscross each other to create a maze of contradictions. The different portraits, which serve different constituencies in the academy and in the marketplace, are to large degree not complementary, but contradictory. So which Jesus should baptize our theology? Or does wisdom side with the cynical sentiment of the old Greek philosopher Xenophanes, "All things are matters of opinion"? My questions are not rhetorical, but sincere, because the answers are not obvious, but obscure. I suppose that in one way or another, I've been pondering them for decades. And the longer I have thought, the more convoluted and challenging everything has become. Like all other non-trivial questions in this vale of tears, the arguments are many, the conclusions few. Again, what should we think? The major critical reconstructions of Jesus differ so much because their authors return various answers to the really significant questions. Why did Jesus go up to Jerusalem? Did he anticipate his own death or even deliberately provoke others to engineer it? If he did sense whither things were tending, with what categories did he interpret his imagined future? What did he mean by the enigmatic circumlocution, the Son of Man? Did he expect God's kingdom to displace in the immediate future all the kingdoms of the world, or are the sayings that seemingly attribute such an expectation to him rather products of the church, or should they bear some other meaning? Some would no doubt protest that I leave the wrong impression. Is it not the case that my chosen field of study is, like the hard sciences, capable of making genuine advances? And that, in fact, much progress has been made? Do we not, for instance, know a lot more today about first century Galilee, first century Aramaic, and first century Judaism than ever before? Do we not now have a much better sense of how the Gospels evolved than did our exegetical predecessors? And is there not, in fact, much upon which the specialists concur? Now, I don't wish to deny that yes is the right response to these questions, although it remains true that some of the older books are still pretty good, while some of the newer books are surprisingly bad. We are not always and uniformly moving onward and upward. And yet a candid observer would surely see little agreement regarding most of the truly interesting and theologically charged questions. Progress has not touched all subjects equally, and whatever consensus may exist, it remains, I think, mostly boring. Almost everyone in the guild takes for granted that Jesus was a Jew who lived in first century Palestine, that his parents were named Mary and Joseph, that he taught in parables, that he had a follower named Peter, that he spoke about God's reign, and that he was crucified in Jerusalem. But without elaboration, these uncontroversial facts engage me about as deeply as a list of the U.S. presidents and their dates. And for theological purposes, such facts are like a rainbow drained of all color. Most of us, instead, would like to know exactly what Jesus meant when he proclaimed the kingdom of God, wouldn't you? Would like to know about his self-conception. Would like to know if he was a sort of pacifist on principle. And would like to know what he saw when he gazed into the future. And yet, even if there were some sort of contemporary consensus on these more interesting and important issues, wouldn't it perhaps be imprudent to build a house of faith upon a recent academic headcount? Today's consensus will be tomorrow's memory. Big books on Jesus are like the clouds. No matter how large, imposing, and beautiful they may be, they never last for long. There will never be any definitive non-canonical edition of his life. We may, out of vanity, imagine that our contemporary results will somehow prove to be more important and to have a longer shelf life than those of our scholarly ancestors, but we will become passé soon enough. Our academic descendants will look back upon our writings as we look back upon the works of the 19th century. Maybe a few of our writings will be of antiquarian interest, but any authority they once had will be long gone. This is one reason why I myself don't use the phrase assured critical result. Those three words, which too often function as a simplification for novices and an excuse for scholars to think less, fail to resonate with my experience, which is rather that the discourse of New Testament scholars keeps changing. Working with assured critical results reminds me a bit of the old saw about shoveling frogs into wheelbarrows. They keep coming out even as one is trying to shovel more in. Study of the historical Jesus belongs to the diversity and pluralism of modernity, or, if you prefer, postmodernity. And there can be no easy appeal to the consensus on much of anything. The Biblical Guild is not a group mind thinking the same thoughts, nor are the experts a single company producing a single product, history. As Chesterton says somewhere, there is no history, there are only historians. The unification of academic opinion would be almost as miraculous as the union of the churches. If you are holding your breath, waiting for the consensus of the specialists, you will pass out. So if we are to do something with the historical Jesus, it's going to have to be somebody's particular historical Jesus, Wright's Jesus, or Crossan's Jesus, or Sanders Jesus. It can no longer be the Jesus of the guild or the Jesus of the scholars, because they, in their writings and at their academic conferences, argue with each other over almost everything. To my mind, the Jesus seminar was not a problem because of its results. Anyone knowing the history of the discipline had encountered such before, but because their publicity machine tried to pass off their conclusions as the official consensus of scholarship. Their voting, however, represented only one school of thought within the guild, not the guild as a whole, for which no individual or group is the elected representative. And have they not already ceased to be the latest fashion? Perhaps I'm being too cynical here, that there are persistent differences on the subject of the historical Jesus is not to say anything surprising or profound. What academic field of study is not riven by the obstinate disputations of the experts? And what religious opinion is without its countless dissenters? If we were to dismiss the quest just because opinions differ, we would also have to abandon theology, which is scarcely a pleasant hamlet of harmony. If we are to believe anything, we must get used to disagreeing with others. And yet, even if one wants to make a theological wager on this or that historical reconstruction, you've got the disconcerting problem of the amateur and the expert. Whereas the quest for the historical Jesus is written up by professionally trained historians, other individuals with a different training typically do our theologizing for us. And don't the latter revert to amateur status when they leave their area of expertise and survey another subject? Perusing books they could not have written and scrutinizing the conflicting arguments of the recognized specialists, are they not a little like me, trying to figure out the brain-mind problem by struggling through a few books of philosophy and neuroscience? What are the odds that I'm going to get much right? Likewise, what are the odds that the theologian or the pastor is going to figure out which historians are the best? There's no referee to declare a winner, only a confusing and interminable game. How, in this era of ever-escalating esoteric specialization, do the amateurs judge the experts? Whom should we follow through the quest's labyrinth of doubt and speculation? If the discord of the experts and the difficulty of judging between them are stumbling blocks for theologians and pastors wanting to do something with somebody's historical Jesus, equally challenging is the circumstance that nobody's historical Jesus is the product of pure historical thinking. All or almost all of the big books on Jesus come with what I think we can call a built-in theology. Some contributors to the quest have, we may grant, no explicit theological interests, and others do an excellent job of hiding theirs. And speaking for myself, I know from introspection and from reading John Meyer's big books on Jesus that even a professing Christian can write about the historical Jesus without consciously trying to score theological points at every turn. But ideology, as everyone should know by now, is everywhere nonetheless. And surely a modern Albert Schweitzer would not struggle to espy the myriad ways in which personal predilections have greatly influenced recent investigations of Jesus. Who doubts that authors who themselves have a high Christology tend to write books in which the historical Jesus had a high Christology? Or that those who are uncomfortable with the decrees of the old church councils more often than not unearth a Jesus who humbled rather than exalted himself? The correlations between personal belief and historical discovery must be endless. Jesus seems friendly to evangelical Protestantism in books written by evangelical Protestants, and he is a faithful Jew in books written by non-Christian Jews who want to reclaim him. It's easy to be suspicious here. You can do anything with statistics, and you can do anything with the historical Jesus, or at least a lot of different things. It's even possible, I've learned to my dismay, to be cynical about oneself. For some time, I've been fascinated by one form of what the literary critics call intertextuality, by how a text augments its meaning by deliberately interacting with well-known predecessor texts. My absorption in this subject led me some time ago to write a book examining the ways, often very subtle, in which the author of Matthew recalls the story of the Exodus and the life of the lawgiver, with the result that his gospel narrates a new Exodus and his Jesus becomes a new Moses. A few years later, I wrote another book, a book on how the texts common to Matthew and Luke, but absent from Mark, relate themselves to the Jewish Bible. I argued that those texts are full of the Old Testament, which they echo, quote, rewrite, and argue with. This second book is entitled The Intertextual Jesus, and its last chapter attempts to pass from our written texts to Jesus himself. I ended up arguing that the flesh and blood Jesus, like his literary namesake in the canonical Gospels, engaged the Jewish scriptures. That is, the intertextual Jesus of Matthew and Luke is not a misleading representative of the historical Jesus who creatively linked his speech and his activities to portions of the Old Testament. It was only sometime after my book on Q appeared, my book on the intertextual Jesus appeared in print, that I opened my eyes to the obvious. I'd created Jesus in my own image, after my own likeness. Having enthusiastically preoccupied myself with the study of intertextuality for a decade, I had happily discovered that the Jesus of ancient Palestine was just like me, at least in one important respect. He may have been a first century Jew, and so in many ways a stranger and an enigma, but he was also skilled at setting up the sorts of intertextual exchanges that I love to unravel. So I had found Jesus, and he just happened to be a learned and admirable expositor, a man after my own intertextual heart. How does it stand with others? Let me briefly consider a second individual, the late Robert Funk, and his being late makes it easier to do this, the principal organizer of the much-beloved and much-hated Jesus Seminar. Funk's theological orientation is manifest from his last book, Honest to Jesus, which is wholly candid about the aim of the quest, which is, to Funk's mind, to set Jesus free. Free him from what? From the ecclesiastical creeds, and especially from the beliefs of the conservative churches of North America. Funk turned the historical Jesus into a wrecking ball with which to bash the walls of institutional creedal Christianity. Whatever the biological impulses may have been, Funk was a well-known type, the anti-fundamentalist. With this in mind, it's fascinating to follow him as he strolls with us through the Jesus tradition, pointing out what represents Jesus and what doesn't. The tradition, it goes without saying, often depicts Jesus as an eschatological prophet, and it regularly presents him as speaking about himself in exalted fashion. The tradition further purports that Jesus thought in terms of the saved and the unsaved, and it frequently has him quoting from and alluding to the Bible. Funk's Jesus, however, is emancipated from all of this. He has no eschatology to speak of, no Christology to speak of, and no soteriology in the traditional sense to speak of, and he shows little interest in the Bible. Funk exports to the post-Easter period all the sayings and stories that might indicate otherwise. Now, although I may be entirely mistaken in this matter, I don't think so, I can't but wonder about the relationship between Funk's theological preferences and his historical conclusions. Eschatology, Christology, soteriology, and the Bible, while at the heart of American fundamentalism, I think they're the four pillars of it, are no part of Funk's personal theology. In fact, he hates them. Jesus is coming again, the fundamentalist says. Funk denies this. Jesus is Lord, the fundamentalist says. Funk thinks otherwise. Jesus saves, the fundamentalist says. Funk has other roles for Jesus. The Bible tells me so, the fundamentalist says. Funk retorts, well, maybe it does, but I quote, it's a highly uneven and biased record. Whereas the fundamentalist cites the Bible, Funk instead appeals to the Jesus he has reconstructed, a Jesus who functions to replace the canonical texts, and who in each instance turns out to be Funk's precursor, not the helpmeet of Funk's religious opponents. Those elements in the tradition most beloved of conservatives conveniently happen to be, without exception, post-Easter fictions. Funk's Jesus is on Funk's side. It seems, a cynic might muse, almost too good to be true. Now, I don't here contend that the utility of Funk's Jesus for Funk means that Funk must be wrong about everything, although I pretty much think he is. His conclusions are offered as the products of arguments, and they merit being met by arguments. They certainly can't be undone by observations about Funk's biography or personal convictions. Were I to imagine otherwise, fairness would require that I shoot ad hominem arrows at my own Jesus on the ground that an intertextually savvy sage is suspiciously congenial. Still, the ease with which Funk's historical Jesus comes to Funk's theological assistance inexorably precipitates within me some suspicion. John Dominic Crossan has worried about this matter of personal predilection a great deal because he has been accused of overlaying his own Irish history onto the Jesus tradition. According to some of his critics, Crossan's interpretation of Jesus as a first century Galilean peasant resisting Roman imperial injustice in the name of Jewish tradition represents the 19th century Irish peasant resisting British imperial injustice in the name of Catholic tradition. In response to this charge, Crossan doesn't deny that there is, in his mind, an analogy between ancient Jews and the modern Irish. Only he insists, sounding to me a bit like the philosopher Gadamer, that we seek the space between narcissism and positivism, which he labels interactivism. By this he means we should attempt to create as honest a dialectic as possible between the past and the present, between the viewed and the viewer. Now, this seems to me a perfectly reasonable response. Although most of us writing about Jesus have theological interests, we can't be dismissed as doing nothing more than whittling a peg upon which to hang our personal agendas. We necessarily see with our own eyes, and whenever we enter a text, we can't leave ourselves behind. The first person singular we always have with us. We also, however, have the magical ability to be self-aware and so self-critical. Not only can we appreciate that our own perspective and our own prejudices are not shared by all, but we can conduct a self-inventory and query our own motives and presuppositions. While we inevitably read ourselves into the text, we can at the same time come to conclusions that neither arise solely from our expectations nor simply confirm our wishes. Furthermore, we are not in this alone, but are members of a guild. The predispositions of one jostle against the predispositions of another in a sort of communal dialectic which enables those who so desire to enlarge themselves. Now, I've just tried to make the best of a worrisome situation. To be predisposed is not, I think, to be inescapably wrong. A predilection need not always blind us. Sometimes it may instead help us to see more clearly. I also believe that we can, if our vision is obscured, sometimes take the log out of our own eye. At the end of the day, however, I can't exercise all my concerns about our biased subjectivity. It remains the case that some Jesus research appears captive to ideological predilections in worrisome ways. If we could but peer beneath all the sophisticated arguments, we would find that much of the disparity in our field is related to intractable differences of philosophical outlook and religious commitment. Well, so much for the problem of discord and diversity in my field of study. For the remainder of this lecture, I should like to contemplate a second issue. What are we doing when we try to isolate the historical Jesus from the church's Jesus? The modern quest began with the English and German deists of the 17th and 18th centuries who were interested in anti-ecclesiastical readings of the evidence. Operating with a hermeneutic of suspicion long before the advent of that term, they doubted that the church's Jesus was the real Jesus. And they set out to prove this. Their goal was to separate truth from fiction, the truth about Jesus from the fiction of the church. They wanted to erase the tellers from their tales and to find the undisguised identity of the historical individual behind the institutional Superman. I understand and I even sympathize. Institutions always rewrite the past and mythologize it to their own ends. And the ancient churches can't be the one exception to this sociological rule. Religious figures do grow in the telling, and memories morph into legends. It makes sense to attempt to disentangle the historical Buddha, if there even was one, from all the fabulous stories later wound about him. It makes sense to seek for the historical Muhammad beneath the mountainous tell of Islamic tradition. And it makes sense to distinguish Francis of Assisi from the Francis of fable, whose delightful miracles multiplied as the decades after his death rolled on. In like fashion, it seems sensible from the historical point of view to quest for the pre-Easter Jesus on the assumption that our sources, like the sources for everybody else who matters, are not innocent of exaggeration and invention. So, we may want to know, what was Jesus like before his pious followers painted over his portrait with their distortions and legends? Can we scrape off the overlay? I understand the question, and I don't reject the enterprise it has generated, an enterprise to which I've tried to contribute. I'm keenly interested in the relationship between story and memory, between memory and interpretation, and between interpretation and misinterpretation. I must confess, however, that with every year of further work, I become more uncertain about anyone's ability, including my own, to extricate Jesus from his interpreters. Matthew 13 assigns to angels the task of separating the good fish from the bad fish, and I think that it may take supernatural talent to go through the net of tradition and throw out what doesn't come from Jesus. So I've become a sort of cynic, not about the tradition, but about our ability. More importantly, I've become much less sure of what exactly it is I'm trying to accomplish when I look for the treasure of Jesus buried in the field of the church. The problem is that I've come to appreciate the obvious, which is that personal identity can't be isolated from social identity. Although many of us have imagined that we put the historical Jesus on display by isolating precisely what he said, precisely what he did, and precisely what he thought about himself, no one's identity can be reduced to words or to deeds or to self-consciousness or to some combination thereof. Let me explain. In serious moments, people sometimes ask themselves, "Who am I?" It's a perplexing question. It encompasses the past, the present, and the future. It must account for feelings as well as thoughts. And the point I wish to underline, it sets before the mind's eye the faces of the many people with whom one has had significant interactions. So the question quickly becomes, who am I in relation to others and who are they to me? I'm reminded of the Russian sociologist Alexander Luria, who reported that when in the 1930s he asked an illiterate peasant in Uzbekistan about his character, the answer was this: "How can I talk about my character? Ask others. They can tell you about me. I can't say anything." Makes sense to me. Before returning to Jesus, it may be helpful to ponder for just a second what critical methods you might employ to investigate the identity of some other human being, say, yours truly. Who am I, really? I suppose that you could ask me, but if you stopped there, the picture would be woefully incomplete and distorted, wouldn't it? I might, of course, be full of helpful facts about myself, although I fear that I might, like Davy Crockett, enjoy throwing in a few entertaining whoppers not wholly tethered to the truth. But I think that you would also want to talk to some other people, say my wife and children. In fact, you can be confident that they know all sorts of things about me that I don't know, or might not think or want to tell you. For the same reason, you desire to interview my brother and other relatives, lifelong friends and current students, participants in the Biblical Guild and faculty colleagues, members of past churches I have attended, and members of the present church I attend. All of these informants, it goes without saying, would enrich your understanding of me, of who I have been and who I am today. To suppose instead that one could find the real or the authentic or the original or the historical Allison by disregarding the testimonies of family, friends, and acquaintances in order to focus solely on what I have said or done would be silly. Maybe, however, we've been a bit silly with regard to the historical Jesus. Maybe we have unthinkingly reduced biography to autobiography. Certainly, we have set aside Matthean redaction and Markan theology so that we could get back to Jesus as he was before people wrote him up. But shouldn't we be more circumspect here? Of course, people can be misunderstood and fictions may be told about them. At the same time, fictions need not be misleading. Many of the legends about Francis no doubt catch his character. And although Heraclitus never said exactly, "You can't step into the same river twice," the aphorism nicely sums up one of his central themes. Beyond that, people can misunderstand themselves or remain oblivious to what others see in them. Even more importantly, they can't take the measure of their lives as a whole, because such becomes apparent only after they have died, perhaps only long after they have died. Giving up the ghost doesn't halt the waves of influence our lives propagate. These continue after we have gone to run into the waves of others, creating new interference patterns. This is why a biography of Abraham Lincoln that can find itself to Lincoln's own words and deeds, a biography wholly lacking the reminiscences and interpretations of others, a biography forbidding admittance of any information subsequent to April 15, 1865, the day of his assassination, would be dissatisfying and riddled with holes. Self-perception is only partial perception, and while the passing of time dims memories, it can also unfold significance. As with Lincoln, so with Jesus, the Nazarene never lived solely to himself, never resided exclusively within his own skin. He was always interacting with others, and their perceptions of him must constitute part of his identity, as must his post-Easter influence and significance. The method of subtraction, the ubiquitous modus operandi of the quest, aspires to erase everything from the record that comes from others or that comes from after Jesus' death, but will that not leave us with an emaciated figure? Let me answer my question with three very quick examples of how Jesus, I think, is present in places where modern historians typically see only the church. Although I may be wrong, the temptation narratives in Matthew 4 and Luke 4 don't strike me as sober, straightforward history. For one thing, and as Origen already observed, there's no high place from which one can see the whole world. For another, doubting the historicity of the similar dialogues between rabbis and Satan strikes me as sensible and turnabout is fair play. Why should I evaluate the synoptic encounter differently? In any event, I concur with many that our story is a delightful Haggadic tale. It's a parable, if you will, largely spun out of Deuteronomy and the Psalms. Now, the Jesus seminar colored all but a tiny portion of Matthew 4, 1 through 11 and Luke 4, 1 through 13 black, thereby indicating that the paragraphs are largely or entirely fictive. Maybe I would have gone along with their vote on this one had I accepted the invitation to join their deliberations, which I didn't. But while a black vote was the end of the story for the Jesus seminar, it's not for me. For this story is steeped in memories of Jesus. Was Jesus not a miracle worker, as our story assumes? Did he not refuse to give authenticating signs, just as here? Did he not think of himself as leading a victorious battle against the forces of darkness, for which Matthew 4 and Luke 4 stand as fitting illustration? Did he not have great faith in God, a fact which the dialogue between Jesus and the devil presupposes and expounds? The temptation narrative may not be objective history or history as it really was, yet it's full of memory. My judgment is that taken as a whole, its artistic originator has managed to leave us with a pretty fair impression of Jesus, even if the episode doesn't contain one word that Jesus spoke or narrate one thing that he did. Memory and legend are not easily disentangled. So when we try to weed out the fictions, will we not be uprooting much else besides? Mark 15, I think, illustrates a related phenomenon. This chapter opens with the appearance before Pilate and ends with the burial by Joseph of Arimathea. Its 47 verses are almost devoid of Jesus' speech. He utters only two sentences, both cryptic. "You, Pilate, have said so," in 15:2, and my God, why have you forsaken me," in 15:34. The chapter also fails to recount any deeds of Jesus because he is throughout a passive victim of violence, bound and led away here, stripped and nailed to a cross there. If then, in our quest for the historical Jesus, we care for little except his words and deeds, Mark 15 would seem mostly irrelevant. Beyond that, furthermore, critical scholars have raised some serious questions about the historicity of much of what's narrated here. It's not just that the darkness attending Jesus' death has its parallels in legends about Adam, Enoch, Romulus, and any number of others. Even more problematic is the luxuriant intertextuality of Mark 15. Everything rests upon scriptural subflooring. The chapter borrows repeatedly, for example, from Psalms 22 and 69, and whereas many Orthodox Christians have found in this the overruling hand of providence, many modern scholars instead find the creative hand of Mark and his predecessors. For Crossan, for example, the passion is prophecy historicized. It's not remembrance, but imagination with a lot of help from the scriptures. But is the narrative in Mark 15 really just another stretch of canon for the Jesus seminar to color 99% black? Is it just ecclesiastical theology in story form? Does the historical Jesus disappear before we get to Mark's last two chapters? I think not. Whatever one makes of the historicity of this or that episode, and whether or not Jesus laconically answered Pilate with "you have said so," or despondently ended his life with my God, why hast thou forsaken me," Mark's stark account mirrors, in my judgment, not only Jesus' character, but also his eschatological expectations. Concerning his character, don't we have in Mark's passion narrative the same man who speaks to us in the Sermon on the Mount? The enigmatic sage who counsels us not to resist one who is evil, who instructs us to turn the other cheek. He has no harsh words for his enemies. Being reviled, he reviles not. He doesn't struggle against his bonds, nor does he spit at those who spit upon him. The man persecuted for righteousness' sake in Mark 15 is the incarnation of the teaching in Matthew's inaugural discourse, which means, if that discourse faithfully manifests the spirit of Jesus, then Mark 15 does the same. As for the relationship between Mark's account of the crucifixion and Jesus' own expectations, our evangelist has constructed a striking series of correlations between his eschatological discourse, Mark 13, and the chapters it introduces, 14 as well as 15. 13:24 foretells that the sun will go dark, and this happens when Jesus is on the cross. 13:2 prophesies that the temple will be destroyed, whereas its veil is torn apart two chapters later. 13:9 foresees that the faithful will be delivered up and will appear before Jewish councils and will be beaten and will stand before governors, all of which happens to Jesus soon enough. 13:35 through 36 admonishes the disciples to watch, lest the master come and find them sleeping. And in Gethsemane, after Jesus tells his disciples to watch, he comes and finds them sleeping. These and other parallels reveal that for Mark, the eschatological discourse and the passion narrative are of a piece. Jesus' death belongs to eschatology. His demise either foreshadows the latter days or it inaugurates them. Although this is a Markan theological construct, it is, to my mind, a descendant of Jesus' own outlook. For along with Albert Schweitzer and many others, I think that Jesus anticipated for himself the fate of a martyr, and that he construed that fate in terms of Jewish eschatology, whose primary pattern is tribulation followed by vindication. That is, Jesus spoke of his end by using end-of-the-world language, and Mark's literary pattern, which makes the end of Jesus a sort of end-of-the-world in miniature, is not independent of the influence of Jesus' own thinking. Jesus' eschatological interpretation of his anticipated fate belongs in the genealogy of causes behind that pattern, which is to say the historical Jesus can show up even in Markan redaction. One more example of Jesus being present where modern historians never think to look. I'm going to leave the Gospels for this and travel to Paul, to his celebrated Psalm of Love in 1 Corinthians 13. This beautiful chapter is entirely Paul's work. It makes no pretense to derive from Jesus, but derive from Jesus, at least in part, it does. Like the Jesus of the Gospels, Paul makes love the chief virtue. Like the Jesus of the Gospels, he says that matters of the heart trump all outward show. Like the Jesus of the Gospels, he calls for patience, kindness, and long-suffering. The exposition of love in 1 Corinthians 13 so strongly recalls Jesus' words and behavior in the Gospels, including his conduct in the Passion narratives, that some earlier commentators, when arriving at this chapter, 1 Corinthians 13, decided that Christ must have been its model. And they even wondered whether the pre-Christian Paul had not, after all, known Jesus of Nazareth, a fantasy for which, of course, there is no evidence. Nonetheless, given that Paul elsewhere shows at least a passing knowledge of Jesus' teaching and character, and that just two chapters earlier he links self-renunciation to Jesus' precedent, surely 1 Corinthians 13 reflects the continuing influence of Jesus' spirit and demands. Jesus wrote nothing to the Corinthians, but without him, 1 Corinthians 13 would not have been written. Origen, when commenting on 1 Corinthians 13, fittingly found the verses illustrated in Jesus, and he quoted Philippians 2, he humbled himself. Paul's ruminations on love, Mark's passion narrative, and the story of Jesus verbally jousting with the devil illustrate, I should like to suggest, what Crossan has termed, albeit with only modern historians in mind, interactionism, the mean between the extremes of positivism and narcissism. The New Testament offers us neither the historical Jesus unsullied by Christian interests, beliefs, and distortions, nor Christian distortions, beliefs, and interests unsullied by the historical Jesus. For there was always a dialectic. Although ideology imposed itself everywhere, Jesus was not an inert, amorphous lump waiting for Christian fingers to give him shape. He was not like poor old Enoch, whose laconic three verses in Genesis set no bounds to speculation, so that he became in Jewish and Christian legend a scribe, a proselyte, a preacher, a judge, a king, and the inventor of sewing. Quite a list of accomplishments for someone about whom we really know nothing at all. Jesus, by contrast, was a real person and a real memory, and he became a living tradition that encouraged some construals and discouraged others. The New Testament is, from one point of view, not so different from the modern books on Jesus, which are always the outcome of give and take between traditions and interpreters. Often, no doubt, we give too much of ourselves and take too little from him. And sometimes we are unwittingly speaking when we assume we are listening. But in the idiom of Matthew, Jesus is with us always, and with us to some extent, I would like to think, in all but the very worst of our modern reconstructions. It's the same in the New Testament, that Paul was never made out to be pre-existent, or never equated with the Logos, or never thought to be one with God the Father, tells us something about the apostle. Whereas the fact that, on the contrary, all this happened to Jesus tells us something about him. Even in John and its soaring discourses, which are scarcely verbatim recall, Jesus remains a real presence. John's high Christology was possible, precisely, at least in my opinion, because Jesus made himself out to be the central figure in God's eschatological scenario. And this stupendous self-perception naturally provoked his followers during and after his ministry to speculate about his distinctive identity. So the construal in John remains part of what we may call the history of Jesus' effects, and that means, I think, part of his identity. If it's true that the ripples of influence radiating from human beings inform us about their identities, and that death doesn't halt those ripples, then what are we doing when in questing for Jesus we separate the authentic materials from the inauthentic? Is this not perhaps a rather crude procedure? Does it not presuppose a stark and uncertain antithesis that needs to be set aside for some new and improved thinking? The question will be all the more pressing, of course, for those of us who celebrate Easter and believe that Jesus can't be reduced to a bundle of memories, however influential, who believe rather that his death was not the end of his activities. If I may, in conclusion, use the language of Paul, Jesus became a life-giving spirit, and he moved into the early Christian texts with their memories and their fictions, with their speculations and their debates. Jesus' life reached beyond itself to live on in others. To ignore them is to know less about him. Thank you very much for your attention.